Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming to the Tattered Cover. We are very, very excited and honored for tonight's author. You may know him from certain films like Saul, Robin Hood Men in Tights. Probably best known for a little film you might know because it's the title of your book. Oh, it's not the title of your book. It's the subtitle of your book. Anyway, my name from The Princess Bride. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming actor and author Cary Elwes.
Wow. Thank you all for showing up. My goodness me. Many more of you than I think we had anticipated. Thank you so much. Wow. Thank you. Let's have some fun.
So, The Princess Bride is an infinitely quotable movie.
Yes. Just a bit.
I think we've all been somewhere for a midnight showing where the entire audience was quoting the film and probably used most of the quotes in everyday life. So, apart from the title of the book, which is probably very special to you, what's your favorite quote from the movie?
Well, I'm kind of partial to a very strange one. I'm kind of fond of anybody want a peanut. I don't know why. Right? Did anybody else get that one? Yeah? Yes? But I know there are far more, far more popular ones that I'm sure many of you can share with us at some point. But anybody want a peanut? I have it easy. You know, folks really want me to say those three words, and I always comply and quite happy to. But someone like Wally Shawn, who plays Vincini in the film, you know, to this day, he tells me if he misses an elevator, someone yells inconceivable at him. You know. And Billy Crystal, if he can't walk into a deli ever again. Someone's going, you want the sandwich lean? And they say it to him as if they think he's never heard it before, you know. So, anyway.
Now, throughout the book, and I think we've all heard this tidbits beforehand, but there's a particularly interesting story about when you were filming with Andre, and you were up against the wall after getting the pill from Miracle Max.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Okay. So, Andre, and I'm sure all of you know the legend and the myth of the great and wonderful Andre the Giant, or else you probably wouldn't be here. But for those of you who might be unaware of who he was, Andre the Giant was literally named very well because he was a giant. All 450 pounds, 7'4", extraordinary. But all heart, the biggest heart you'll ever meet. He would give you the shirt off his back. It would be enough for five people. But he'd still be happy to give it to you. And he always had a smile on his face. And my first day shooting with him was on, as you say, Michael, on the parapet. They built this wonderful fake parapet outside Haddon Hall, which is a beautiful castle in Derbyshire, where we did all the exterior filming. And it was made out of plywood and plaster, and it was meant to match Florin Castle and so on. Anyway, so I'm on the wall there with Mandy and with Andre. And I think Fezzik has the first line. By the way, if I get the lines wrong, it's 27 years, so forgive me. I'm sure you can all correct me and feel free to. But I think Fezzik has the first line, and Fezzik says, I wonder how long before it takes effect. Or something like that. And Montoya says, your guess is as good as mine. And then I come to and I say, I'll beat you both together. I'll fight you both apart. Something like, yeah? Is that close? It's close enough. I'll fight you both apart. And, or I'll beat you both apart. You can quote me. And Fezzik has the line, I guess not very long. Like that, right? And on the first take, Andre didn't even get to the word long when he emitted the most powerful and monumental fart. I mean, you have no idea. Look, we've all experienced what we've considered to be giant farts. This was a giant's fart, people. Somebody timed it. It was 15 seconds. And the sonic resonance of which was just, I mean, it was ear-splitting. And most folks on the set thought there was like an earthquake, and everyone sort of grabbed a piece of the parapet that was shaking. And I looked over at Andre, and he had this beautiful, blissful look of relief, like something he'd been holding on to but just had to let go of. And I noticed there was steam coming out of the top of his head. I don't know. I swear to this day, I don't know why. I think he was either too hot or it was part of the fart. I just don't know. And that, I couldn't look at him for too long on that level. And this was still going on, this 15-second fart, still going on. I mean, just ear-splitting. I looked over at the sound man, and he'd lifted the headphones off his, like that. And after it was over, there was this stunned silence. It's not like here in the States. You guys all are so cool about farts. Everyone was sort of like, dude, really? Or, you know, everyone like calls it here. You know what I mean? It's like a uniquely American phenomenon. Whoa. Describe it. Share it. In England, everyone's very polite. Look at the weather. So there was this equally stunning silence after this fart that could be heard in Beijing, you know. And on when it was over, Rob Reiner broke the silence after a long pause. He went, I'll never forget. Rob Reiner, the director, he goes, "Hey, Andre, you okay?" And Andre said, "I am now, boss." Swear to God. And that was the first day with Andre. And so, yes, it was monumental and quite memorable. Yeah.
That was fantastic.
So was the fart.
Quite fair. But I think we all, I know me especially, would love to hear about Billy Crystal's improvisation
okay.
on set.
Yes. Billy Crystal, who plays Miracle Max, was the only person allowed to really improvise in the movie. The rest of us all had very, very specific dialogue written by the wonderful William Goldman, who also wrote the novel. And you may know William Goldman. If you don't, he's an incredible author, I think a national treasure. He wrote Marathon Man, All the President's Men, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Misery. He's an extraordinary writer. Anyway, my first day, and my only day, really, with Billy was me and on the slab of the hovel, mostly dead, yes? And I'm thinking, what an easy day for me, you know, right? I had all of two words to learn, which is true love or true to blave, if you care to believe that's what I said. And Billy had 8 hours of makeup. He and Carol King, God bless them, who played Valerie, his wife, had 8 hours of makeup, to all this latex and to make them look old and fake ears and fake noses and wigs. And anyway, I got to watch Billy prepare for the role. I got to see him get into makeup. He brought his makeup artist from Saturday Night Live, a guy called Peter Montagna, and he said he wanted to look like a cross between his grandmother and Casey Stengel, the Yankees manager. And when he was done, he looked a lot like Dopey, like a very old Dopey. But he had this wonderful wig and eyebrows that were so large that his feet would never get wet in the rain. It was just insane. And he stayed in character. As soon as he got the cataract contact lenses in, he just started going into Miracle Max and going, and walking around like that all day. And he even went to the commissary, which is the where you eat food on the studio lot. And I'll never forget, he was standing in line, and he asked the lady behind the counter, he goes, "The shepherd's pie, is it spicy?" And she goes, "No, I don't think so." And he goes, "You don't know my colon." Things like that, you know, he's just... totally there as Max. Anyway, so I'm lying on the slab. Cut to me lying on the slab, right? I'm thinking easy day, first day, the great Billy Crystal. And he's wandering around the set and he's already totally in character, right? And Rob Reiner comes up to me and he goes, "Hey, Gary, I looked in the monitor and we can see your chest moving when you're breathing. You got to be dead, so you got to stop breathing." And I said, "For how long, Rob? I mean, okay. I'm not Jacques Cousteau, you know? Don't worry, we're not going to kill you. Just a couple of seconds, and, you know, it's longer than that, but anyway." And then he wandered over to Billy, and he whispered something in his ear, and I didn't know what he whispered in his ear until much later on, but I found out that what he whispered in his ear was, "Just go for it." Not that Billy needed much coaxing, but as soon as Rob yelled action, Billy launched into 3 hours of medieval Yiddish stand-up. Some of which was very, very blue and can't be repeated because there are children here. And it was just ludicrous, all of it. It was just absolutely hilarious and ludicrous at the same time. And Rob, who has a very boisterous laugh, I describe it as a laugh that can be heard in Detroit, was ruining every take. And the sound man came up to him and went, by the way, English crews call the directors in England, they call all directors are known as governor. So he came up to him and went, "Oh, sorry, governor, can't get through a scene with that laugh. You'll have to leave the set." So the director was banished from his own set, which I've never heard of or since or before. And they set up a monitor of him outside the soundstage in the hallway. And then it was up to me to be very, very still while he continued to do medieval Yiddish stand-up. And, of course, that's impossible when it's like being in church when you've been told not to laugh. I mean, it was forget it. And so the sound guy went, "You too, I'm afraid, Mr. Elwes, you have to go, I'm sorry." And they replaced me with my rubber dummy. So if you look at the scene now and all the wide shots, that's a rubber mannequin, which some critics claim should have been in more scenes. I'm not going to argue with that. And I had to go and join Rob in the hallway. And Mandy Patinkin claims that he bruised a rib trying not to laugh. I didn't know you could do that. But Mandy said that's the only injury he got on the film was bruising a rib trying not to laugh at Billy Crystal. But I think you can go online. I don't know if they pulled them now, but while I was writing the book, I actually found a site that had some raw footage of some of Billy's outtakes with all the crew laughing. So it wasn't just Rob and myself for responsible for it. There were a lot of people laughing on the set that day. I don't know if they pulled it, but yeah, I'm sure some of you wonderful internet explorers out there will be able to find it if you can. Yeah.
Well, speaking of an injury, I heard that you had an injury with an all-terrain vehicle around set.
Yes.
What happened there?
Oh, yes. Well, okay, so when we went on location, after we left Shepperton Studios where we shot Miracle Max and the Fire Swamp and everything, we went on location to Derbyshire and to Haddon Hall, which I mentioned before. And all the scenes outside where you see these mountainous areas, that's called the Peak District. And it's well-named because it's very hilly and very filled with peaks and rocks. And Andre, who walked at a pace of literally a mile an hour, if that, God bless him, couldn't fit in the van that took the cast and crew up to the set. And he couldn't fit in any regular car. He had his own modified pickup truck that he had specially made that they brought over for him. Actually, I think it was a Mack truck. And that was his trailer, God bless him. He lived in the back of a Mack truck the whole time. Never complained. He was just great. Anyway, so the production manager thought, we're never going to get Andre up to the set at that pace that he's walking, you know, because Rob wanted to shoot at the top of all these mountains. I want the vista. Look at this view, this thing. You know. So the production manager went up to Andre and said, Andre, how do you get around on your farm at home? I mean, I'm assuming you've got a lot of acres. How do you get around? And Andre said, I use an ATV, boss. He called everybody boss, by the way, which is hilarious for a 7'4" guy. You know, everyone is looking at him like that. And so they found And this you can Google image right now if you want to. They found the only all-terrain vehicle, I think, that was available in Great Britain at the time. It's a three-wheeler, a little red thing. It looked like a tricycle under him. You just Google Andre the Giant and all-terrain vehicle, and you'll see him in costume, smiling bigger than you've ever seen him smile. You never saw a giant move so fast. I mean, he would zoom around this thing, and no matter what you were doing, you'd stop what you were doing, and you'd, whoa, was that Andre? You know? And he loved it. And he would zoom up to me on it, and he'd go,
hey, boss.
I go, hi, Andre.
You like my dog?
Looks great. You kind of know where the story is going, right?
You want to try it?
I don't think so. Take off again. Day two, same thing.
Hey, boss.
Yes, Andre.
My toy, you want to try?
No, it's okay. This went on for like 4 days. Finally, on like the fourth or fifth day, he came up to me, and I was about to shoot the scene with Robin where we roll down the hill, and I say those three words. And he came up, he went... I went, hi, Andre. He goes,
you know you want to.
That was the point where my hubris exceeded my aptitude. And I said, oh, all right, Andre, fine. So he got off this thing. It went up another 2 feet as he got off it. And his bodyguard, like he needed, this guy had the easiest job on the set. I mean, guarding Andre from what? Mosquitoes? What? Ridiculous. This guy walked up and went, oh, it's very easy, governor. It's just like a motorbike. You know, clutches over there, brake pedal, on off switch, Bob's your uncle. That should have told me everything, that I should not be getting on this machine. It's not a toy, even though Andre, it was for him, obviously. So I get on this thing with a lot of bemused crew looking at me in full, you know, dread pirate outfit. And I took the mask off. I thought that was a smart move on my part. And I put it in gear, and it lurched forward. It was like being on a rodeo horse. It was just ridiculous. And I went over a rock immediately and broke my left toe. I got it caught between the clutch pedal and just snapped like that. And I went, oh, no, 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 not the toe, not the toe. And I thought, that's it. That's it. I mean, I've blown it. I went like 10 days or something into shooting, and we obviously hadn't shot the sword fight or anything. Of real action, of running or anything like that. And I thought, that's it, I'm done for. And the crew came running over, set nurse came over, and I'm acting like the Black Knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I'm going, it's nothing, it's fine, it's probably just a sprain, something. The set nurse comes over, she goes, I just want to touch it. So she touches the boot, and she goes, does that hurt? I said, no, it's fine. She goes, I'm going to have to take the boot off and have a look. I went, fine, sure, no problem. They take the boot off, and they're very painful, just taking the boot off, and then they can see that my toe, I mean, it's all bent in the wrong direction, everything, it's crazy. And she looks at it, and she looks back up at me, she goes, I think it's broken. And I said, no, it's not. No, it's fine. She goes, yeah. It's broken. And I'm freaking out. Now I'm sweating, just totally sweating. And the first AD is coming over, and one, the first assistant director calling with the, you know, to tell me to come to set, to work, to shoot the scene. And I'm panicking, and I say to her, all right, what can you do? You know, you're the set nurse, what can you do? And she goes, well, I'll look in my bag, but I mostly deal with, you know, things like tummy up. I've got something for a tummy upset. Is something for a day. I mean, I'm not prepared for broken limbs and things. And now I'm going, oh, great. What am I going to do? I go, is there anything you can do? Anything at all? She goes, I suppose I could make a makeshift splint. I said, great. Do that. So I think she used a couple of twigs and some, you know, and some tape. And tape together, try to put the toe in the right direction. Put the sock back on. That was interesting. Then the boot wouldn't fit. Of course, the boot wouldn't fit with all the padding on it. Oh, great. They had to cut a hole in the back of the boot. right? Slipped it on, and I'm thinking, I'll be fine. I mean, this is how crazy I was. You make terrible decisions when you're, you know, in your 20s and teenager, whatever. And I thought, I'll just wing this. I'll make it through it. And I've got a broken toe, but I'm pretending everyone, I'm fine. Thinking, don't tell Rob, you know, like he wouldn't find out. Everyone's got a walkie-talkie, you know. Don't tell him, I'll handle it. Don't worry, it's fine. I get in the van to go up to the location where Robin is waiting to shoot this scene where I confront her for marrying Humperdinck. And it's the longest ride I've ever taken in any vehicle. And the first AD is behind me with the set nurse. I remember her leaning over to him and going, I think he fell on his head as well. Get out of the van, and there's Rob by the monitor waiting. And he's scratching his beard, looking at me. And I'm thinking, he doesn't know. There's no way he can know. I'll just brazen it. I'll just get through the pain and make it through it, right? So I walk up to him, putting all the weight on this foot, like nothing's happened, right? And as I walk up to him, he goes, hey, Gary, how you doing? And I'm thinking, he can't possibly know. I said, I'm fine, Rob. How are you? He goes, I'm good. How you doing? And I broke down. I said, gosh, Rob, I'm so sorry. I feel like such a twit. I was fooling around on Andre's all-terrain vehicle. I shouldn't have been on it, and I broke my toe. He goes, you think I don't know? Everybody's got a walkie-talkie here. First thing I heard is somebody saying, you're going to see Carrie can't walk too good. I said, I'm so sorry, Rob. Please forgive me. I was afraid to tell you. I thought you'd fire me and everything. He goes, what do you mean fire you? I ain't going to fire you. You're wonderful in this role. What, can you walk? I go, I can. Yeah, I think so. He goes, can you run? I go, that will be interesting for the next couple of days. And he said, well, let's just work around it. And we got to shoot this scene and we'll deal with it later. So if you look at that scene, the scene where I'm sitting down against the log to talk to a Buttercup and I put my hands behind my... You can see I'm lying down in the most ridiculous manner. I put my foot up like that. Trying to act all cool and everything. You know, the coolest Dread Pirate. Everything's fine. And you look at it now, it's ludicrous. It's totally ludicrous. And Rob had no idea. He actually thought it was really cool. He was like, man, you sat down so cool. How'd you do that? I went, Rob, it's because of the broken toe. I can't put any weight on it, you know. So it was pretty tender. If you look at the film, we shot it out, obviously, out of sequence. I think you can really spot it when I'm running into the fire swamp with holding Buttercup's hand. I'm literally hopping into the fire swamp. It's pretty ridiculous. But, you know, we had to work around it, and thank God it was pretty well healed by the time we came with the sword fight sequence at the very end of the movie. So it smarted a bit, but was mostly healed by then. So, yes.
Very similar to Mostly Dead.
So I learned two things from that encounter. One, always tell the truth. It's much easier. And I'm not pointing you out in particular. And two, don't go fooling around on an all-terrain vehicle when you have no idea how to use it, because it's not a toy. And that was the first and last time I ever got on one of those things. Yes.
All right. I could just sit here for a long time. Yeah. And I think everybody else probably is the same. They don't have anywhere to go. Yeah. Okay. Now, so at what point did you kind of realize what you had, like the significance of The Princess Bride? Like, it's lasted so long and all of, you know, just its impact. Like, when did you kind of...
For me, it was very interesting. You know, the film, when it came out, was not a big commercial success, believe it or not. We, back in 1987, when it was went into theaters, the marketing department at 20th Century Fox really didn't know how to market the film, because they'd never had a film with such a mishmash of genres, you know. They didn't know, was it a fairy tale, an adult film, a kid's film, a comedy, whatever. You know, they had no action film. They had no idea how to pitch it. So they opted for the kid's movie version, and they came up with this beautiful, I'm sure you've seen it, the Maxfield Parrish poster, and it has Peter Falk, the grandfather, talking to Fred Savage, the grandson in silhouette, I think, and it's like a teddy bear on the ground or something like that. And with the title, most folks thought it was just a kid's movie, and quite rightly so with that kind of poster, and they largely stayed away. And of course, we were all a little disappointed by that, and so the movie kind of went away, and we all went on with our lives, and about a decade later, the VHS market took off. How many people here still have their VHS copies, by the way? There you go. I mean, extraordinary. How many of you had it passed down from someone in your family to you? Quite a few. Quite a few. What, you other, all of the rest of you are holding on to it from the, way back then? Wow. And you still have VHS players? Not so many. God bless you for that. So yeah, thanks to the VHS market, you guys started buying it and renting it and giving it to friends and family, and then the cable market started to take off. And that was about 10 years later. I was in a restaurant in Manhattan. I was living in Manhattan at the time, and I was ordering a hamburger, and the waitress said, "How do you want that cooked?" And I said, "Oh, medium rare, please." And she went, "As you wish." I said, "Excuse me," and she winked and went, "You know," and it was weird and wonderful at the same time. I mean, this film that had been mostly dead—yes, I had to say it—mostly dead for almost a decade, suddenly came back to life, and thanks to all of you, it's now become this wonderful thing. And I think, honestly, I can speak on behalf of everyone involved with the film when I say that we all feel unbelievably blessed that you have taken this film to your hearts and have shared it from one generation to the next. And it's beyond our wildest dreams, really extraordinary. So I thank all of you. You can clap for yourselves for that.
So do you want to do a few audience questions?
Sure.
All right, we'll do. See, does anyone have a question? Probably, right back, straight there. Yes.
Ah. Yeah.
So the question is,
yes.
And everybody has really busy schedules.
Yes.
But it would be wonderful if you all would do a movie, possibly even in a different genre or anything together again.
You know, I think we'd love to because we're all still in touch. We're all connected now through this wonderful film. And, we'd like to, you know, there was talk at one point of obviously of doing a sequel. You know, Bill Goldman, the author, tried to write a sequel. It's, you can find it in the 25th anniversary edition of The Princess Bride, and it's called Buttercup's Baby. But he couldn't finish it. Poor guy. He said at the 25th anniversary reunion, he said he wanted to finish it and write it more than anything he's ever not written, but that he just couldn't lick it, meaning he couldn't finish it. And if he can't write it, then I don't think there's ever really going to be a sequel. But as for doing a film together in another genre, that would be lovely. I mean, I told Chris Guest, who is just fantastic at doing those kinds of films, that it would be kind of fun. I think what would happen, though, is that everyone would go, "Oh, the Princess Bride cast back together." If you're okay with that, I certainly am. But I don't know how critics might fare with that. I don't know. But it certainly would be fun. And I had such a good time making the film, as you can tell. And that's why I wrote this book. So I would love to do it again. Yes.
All right. We're going to do...
Yep. Besides the sword scene, what was your favorite scene to film?
Thank you. What's your name?
Donna.
Hi, Donna.
So for the thing... I'm so good at this. All right. So besides the sword, beside the sword scene.
Yes.
It's a bit of a tongue twister. Sword fighting scene. What was your favorite scene to film?
My favorite scene to film?
From Donna.
It's hard, honestly, Donna, to pinpoint. I was asked that at the 25th anniversary reunion. I was asked, what was my favorite scene to shoot? And you did. So you know my answer. But, oh, really? Donner's testing me. You think I didn't go to sleep last night, didn't you? I honestly, Donna, it's true. It's why I wrote this book. I can barely remember a day without laughter on this movie. And so it's hard for me to pinpoint any one particular moment because the whole journey was so joyous for me. And that's why I wanted to share that with everyone. I wanted to write that as a love letter to the fans and to my colleagues and to celebrate and be grateful for this incredible gift I've been given, you know? Thank you.
All right, another. I'm gonna get somebody standing. Let's go to the side. You in the white hat? So, what role since then has been the closest to Wesley?
Well, I haven't. I guess on a swashbuckling terms, I guess Robin Hood. I guess. Right. Thank you. Yes, I swore after Robin Hood I wouldn't take any more, swashbuckling roles. And I got offered quite a few, as you can imagine. But, you know, when Mel Brooks calls, you know. And he called me at home. I thought it was a prank. I picked up the phone and I went, hello? And he went, is Mel Brooks here? And I went, yeah, right. Ring, ring. Seriously. No, don't hang up. It's really me. And that's how it started. It was incredible. So I couldn't say no to Mel, you know. So I had a lot of fun making that, too. A lot of fun. Yeah.
All right. Maybe one more, you think? Or
A couple more?
All right.
Fun, right?
Let's go with the gentleman right back here.
Actually, I happen to be a wrestling fan. Any good Andre
13
stories?
Aha. Okay. Here's the PG version, because there are kids here. After the New York premiere, there were two premieres of the film. One was at the Toronto Film Festival in 1987, and the other one was at New York, and I think it was at the Ziegfeld Theater, I think. Don't quote me on that. I think it was. And after the premiere, everybody was going their separate ways, and Andre, who was sitting next to me, went, you want to go out, boss? And I thought, well, how am I going to pass up the opportunity to go out with Andre the Giant in Manhattan? I, of course. Yes, absolutely. By the way, you never say no to a giant. I mean, I don't think it's not like he's ever heard that word in his whole life. Who's ever gone, no? Sorry. No. Absolutely not. So, yes, of course. I went, absolutely, let's go. And he went, great, boss, let's go. And we went out, and I think he had his friend with him, a guy called Frenchie, and we got inside his. He did have a modified pickup. It was a very large pickup, as I remember, pickup truck or SUV, something like that, an early version of an SUV in 1986, or 87, excuse me. And we went out, and we went to a place called P.J. Clark's. Does that ring a bell? Does that sound right? P.J. Clark? Yeah. That was the first place we went. And we walked in, and, of course, it was like an old Western where the pianola stops, and it went, ding. Everybody looked, you know, because Andre, you know, he, and there was no door frame that could fit this poor guy. He always had to bend down to his knees coming in. And then he'd go up to his full height, and it was like that. And I said to him, boy, Andre, you always make an interesting entrance, don't you? He goes, don't worry, boss, everybody know me. And I thought to myself, of course they do. I mean, how could they not know you, you know? And we went up to the bar, and he sat on two stools, and the bartender went, hey, Andre, how you doing? You want the usual? Yeah, please, thank you. And the usual for Andre was something called an American. And an American was a beer pitcher filled with literally everything the bartender could pour into it from behind. And, you know, he literally went down the row of all these bottles, and whatever, and he would just nod. Andre go, this?
Yeah.
That one?
Yeah.
I mean, gin, vodka, brandy, wine. Kids, don't try this at home. Please, I don't want any angry emails, please.
And he would drink this thing. And what's so funny is the beer pitcher in his hand looked like the size of a shot glass. Again, you want to reference Google Andre the Giant and beer can, and that's a normal size beer can in his hand, believe it or not. It's not an airplane one. It's a real thing. It's extraordinary. It's like this, and it's crazy. And he would down it like water. I mean, he would just drink these things one after another. And I remember he asked me what I wanted to drink. And he would never let anyone buy anything. You could never buy a meal for Andre or buy a drink for Andre. Andre always had the tab. And God bless him. And he go, "What do you want, boss?" I went, "I'll just have a beer, please." And he went, "Come on, boy, what do you want?" I went, "I'll have a beer, Andre. I may look stupid, but I'm not an idiot. I can see what you're drinking." So I nursed a beer, sipped it very carefully, and thought I'd pace myself. I realized this is the first bar of probably many we were going to hit. And so I was just, and we sat down and we chatted and about his life and everything. It was wonderful. And we went on to the next bar, and I noticed somebody sitting way in the back of the bar, the next bar we went to, who had already been at the previous bar. I thought, oh, it's a fan. You know, it's normal. I mean, it's Andre. I'm sure people follow him around. All it's not like you can't lose Andre. You know, if you wanted to follow him, you can find him, you know. And I thought nothing of it. He finished another eight Americans. I nursed my next beer very slowly, didn't finish it. Next bar, same guy. And I thought, okay, this is probably a stalker. I should probably warn Andre. This could get weird. Because, you know, you don't want to be stalking Andre, right? I mean, really, you have to be insane to do that. So I leant over and I said, "Hey, Andre." He goes, "What, boss, what?" I said, I think there's a guy following you. And he went, what, like that. I thought to myself, if this guy was trouble, it wasn't going to be trouble for long. And he looked behind him and then he turned back and he went, "Oh, don't worry about him, boss." I went, "You know him?" He said, yeah, long story, but..." I get, "Andre, it's 2 a.m. We've got time. What's the story?" He goes, and so he proceeded to tell me that he'd been out drinking in New York one time and he slipped and fell. He said it wasn't because he was drinking. He slipped because it was wet outside and waiting for his car from the valet and fell on a patron who must have thought a building was landing on him. And ever since then, NYPD had sent an undercover cop to follow him. Make sure he didn't fall on anyone again. And I never forget, he said to me, he goes,
"They thought, they said it's for my own protection, boss."
He promptly turned around and told the bartender to buy the guy a drink.
Yeah, get him one, get anything you want.
So this guy, this is the greatest, New York undercover cop. It's not that undercover, who basically had a free drink every night. Oh, every time he went out, he got a free drink from Andre. So that guy was like, "Thank you." Yeah. And that was my night drinking with Andre, yes. Wow. And I did have a hangover, even with eight beer. And I'm a lightweight. And he was fine. By the way, didn't slur his words, nothing. 23 Americans later. Extraordinary. Extraordinary.
Wow. All right.
Yes. You pick.
Let's go with you and the flowers, I think.
Yeah. Hi.
So I had a question about the Miracle Pill from the movie.
Yes.
And whether or not that gave you your 50 years of life back.
Ah! Yes, you mean in real life or in the movie? It was made out of foam latex rubber and carefully painted with brown paint by the props department. And no, I didn't swallow it. I just put it in my mouth and tried very hard while lying down flat not to swallow it because I knew that would definitely hold up shooting till it came out again. And... no, then they painted it with some, I don't know what they used, some fluid they put on it. But if you want to believe for real it gave Wesley back his 50, yes, by all means, yes it did. I do not want to spoil that fantasy for you.
All right, let's go up on the stairs all the way up there.
Hi. Yes.
How did you accommodate those prone scenes?
So, out of all the scenes where you were prone, the torture room, the bedroom at the end, and the Miracle Max, how did you accommodate being prone so long?
I studied in my hotel room. Honestly, you're the first person who's ever asked me that. That's extraordinary and fascinating at the same time, because I never thought of that. And you're absolutely right. There are three scenes where I'm laying prone and flat. What a great day's work that was for me. Very, very hard and exhausting. It's funny. I never thought of it. Yes, you're right. Three times Wesley's on his back. I do some of my best work on my... No, I didn't say that. I did not. Who said that? Naughty. No. Anyway, thank you for that fascinating and revealing question. And we shall have to edit that out of the podcast.
Go with the beard right here. Yeah.
If you had to go back and then choose a different life path, if you had to not be an actor, what would you do?
Oh, boy.
If you had to choose a different life path and not be an actor, what would you do?
I think if I had to do something else, it would have to be connected to this wonderful business called show business. I do love the work I do. I love being around films and television, and I just love the process. I started out as a production assistant, actually, and that's how much I love it. I started out making coffee for people. Not very good coffee, so don't ask me right now. It's not good, I promise you. But I used to have to print call sheets, which are the work orders you get each day that tells you the scene number and the location and so on. And that was my job starting out. So I think I would have to pick something to do with the film industry, something just to be around. I love being around sets. I love being around movies, and I love being part of it. So not sure what, but something, yes. Although I have written a screenplay, yes. So that's exciting. It's being made into a film right now. I know. Isn't that incredible? Incredible. Inconceivable, you may say. It's called Elvis Nixon, and it stars Kevin Spacey as President Nixon and Michael Shannon as the great Elvis Presley. So, yes, that's going into production in about 3 weeks. So.
Wow.
Keep our fingers crossed. And please go see it and tell your friends. Tell your friends and family. It's a lot of fun. Had a lot of fun writing it, that's for sure, and lots of great history. And it's meant to be a comedy, of course. And, yes. Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Let's go with the hat right there.
Hey, sir, real quick. Do you ever feel that the role typecast you? And have you ever felt that pressure because of it? Or is that, I can't believe people still see me as that guy.
So have you felt typecast by Wesley?
I honestly feel blessed by this role. Honestly, I think as an actor, you're fortunate to have any role you play resonate with anyone, or any movie or TV show resonate with anyone. You know, I know wonderful actors who've worked their whole lives and don't have a single role that anyone can remember at all. And they're just, I don't know, you know? And so I think I'm blessed. I consider myself very blessed. I have more than one movie, but this one is very special to me. It's why I wrote this book. And I'm sure when I die, it'll either have As You Wish or Mostly Dead on my tombstone, one or the other. And that's cool. I'm cool with that. I'm okay. That's fine.
the second one would be funnier. And I'm fine with that. No, really, I feel very blessed. And that's why, again, why I wrote this book. I'm celebrating how fortunate and blessed my life is to be here with all of you, talking about it and sharing it with you. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm. At this point in your career, what would be your next dream role if you could do anything?
What is your next dream role if you could do anything?
I don't really have a dream role per se. There's the genres I haven't done yet. I'd like to stretch myself to. I mean, I'd like to do a Western, I think. I kind of look good on a horse, I think. I've been on a horse a couple of times. I can wrangle that. And a good Stetson. And some good lines. Yeah. I don't know. I'd like to try that. I don't know. But yeah, I don't really have any particular role. I mean, like, I'd like to try Shakespeare. I mean, I am British and no one's ever asked me. Go figure. Maybe they just go, we'd rather have the rubber mannequin.
So. All right. Yeah.
So I'm curious for you, what challenged you
most? So out of TV and film and all your different genres of horror and action, what pushed you the most?
Probably being chained to a wall 18 days in a row in Saw. I didn't realize that I was actually really physically going to be chained to a wall for that length of time. And by the way, there was only one guy with a key on the set, and Lee Whannell, who plays the other actor in the scene, both of us kept a keen eye on every movement that guy made. And anytime he put his hand in his pocket, what's he doing? Take out his keys and fumble with them. No, you don't drop them. I think they did go missing one day, and we missed lunch, which was not fun. I love a challenge. I think life is about the cards you're dealt and how you deal with them, you know, and challenges. I love a challenge. It's not a problem to me. It's always a challenge. That's how I look at life. And so throw me one, and I'll tackle it. And I like that. It's fun. Yeah. Yes.
Sir? Yeah.
Actually, my daughter had a question.
Yep.
She wanted to know what it was like fighting a giant rat.
What was it like fighting a giant rat? What's your name, young lady?
Lorelai.
What a beautiful name. Do you want to come up here and ask? Come on. Come on, little princess. We like little princess. I have a 7-year-old. How old are you?
Oops, sorry.
How old are you?
8 and a half.
8 and a half? Aren't you sweet? Look at your magnificent sweater. Did mommy or daddy get that for you?
It was passed down from some of my friends.
That's so sweet. Your name's Lorelai?
Yes.
You're very sweet. You know that, don't you?
Yeah.
Has anyone ever told you how cute you are?
A lot of people. Yeah.
You're going to have to get used to it. I know it can be trying sometimes, but it's true. You know, if more than two people tell you, there must be some truth to it, you know. So you liked... How many times have you seen the film, by the way? More than twice?
I've seen about a million.
Ladies and gentlemen, the biggest Princess Bride fan, Lorelai. 1 million viewings. And you're still here to share that with. That's extraordinary. 1 million viewings. And how old were you when you first saw it, by the way? Because, I mean, 1 million viewings, I'm going to work out the math here, but I'm hoping that mommy and daddy didn't show it to you in the maternity ward.
Yes. Actually, I I've been stealing it from my parents.
You do realize that video piracy is responsible for the loss of at least 50% of revenue for films still. I'm teasing. So it's all right. It's quite all right to watch it that many times. You're very, very sweet. And the rodents of unusual size, they didn't scare you when you first saw them?
No, not really.
Wow, you're very brave. Okay, so did you know there were little people inside of those suits?
No.
That is the testament to the wonderful acting of these little people, because there were little people inside. Little people not much bigger than you. Can you believe that?
Not really.
No. It's true. And they had to be sewn inside those hot suits that were made out of foam, latex, rubber, and fur. And so someone your size, after they were sewn into it, end up being that size. And they had to crawl around with these massive lights on them all day long and pretend to be rodents of unusual size and pretend to bite me with rubber teeth. It was very funny at the time. Wasn't supposed to be, but it was. And I'm sorry, going back to your question was, do you remember?
No.
We've digressed, but we've had so much fun here. Does anyone remember her question? No. What was it like fighting them? It was funny. Like I said, here's a funny story. One of the guys who I was supposed to fight with, the one who chewed my neck, did that scare you at all when he was chewing my neck?
It's just a movie. I don't really get scared by the action. I think that's a cool part.
I think we have a new studio head in the making. I was terrified. But no. So this one guy who was supposed to fight me as a rodent of unusual size, he missed that day's work. He missed most of it. And so the director of the film said to me, "Hey, Gary, why don't you fight the rubber rat instead?" Yeah, that's what I... There was a stunned silence from me as well. And I said, "Really, Rob, you want to use the rubber?" "Yeah, we'll make it work. You can move the arms and play with the tail. It'll look real." So did you know I shot about 5 hours of this silliness of me rolling around on the floor with a rubber rat? That's like you taking one of your teddy bears out and wrestling it and saying, "Mommy and Daddy, this is a real bear. Promise you." That's what it was like. And you can, if you look in the book, there's a picture of me staring down at it with complete disdain while Rob's going, "Yeah, you hold the teeth open and then you clamp down on yourself and it'll look real." Anyway, please give a big round of applause for the next movie studio mogul, Lorelei. Thank you.
Okay.
Take a bow. Bye. She's wonderful. A million times. You have a wonderful daughter. She's very sweet.
Are you gonna do more?
What do you think? How late are we going?
I don't know.
We've got kids here. What do you think? Is it time to get the... Yeah, is it time to get them? But yeah, it's past my bedtime. We'll take one or two more, and then we should probably get going, yeah?
Okay.
All right.
Let's do with the highlight. Purple.
Yes. Hi. What's your name?
Tina.
Hi, Tina.
Was it more difficult to work with Billy Crystal or Jim Carrey? And
ha!
So is it more difficult to work with Billy Crystal or Jim Carrey?
Well, Billy was just one day. Jim was every day. And Jim improvises every scene. There's no two takes the same. I mean, it's just, yes, extraordinary. You know that scene where he's beating himself up in the bathroom? If you go back and replay that scene, you can hear his head hit the concrete floor when he beats himself up. He really did that. And you could have heard, I mean, the producers screamed, like, cut, and rushed up to him. And he stood up and he was like, what? And everyone was like, but you just smashed your head on the ground. We could hear it. I mean, they decided to leave the sound of that in because you just can't do that in post. And that's him really beating him. I mean, he's hilarious. So, yes. A lot of ruined takes. Not all from me. But from the crew as well. So, yes.
All right. Let's do one more. Let's get somebody maybe standing in the back. You had your hand up for a while. Yeah.
Last one. Okay.
Savannah.
Hi, Savannah.
I'm not a million fan, but I'm definitely a huge fan.
Thank you. Okay.
And how did that compare? I mean, just on set, I mean, obviously, not really, I mean, two different roles, but just want to know about Robin Hood and Tyler.
Sure.
I think
absolutely.
We all want
okay.
to know about men in tights.
Yes.
Very much. So, manly men. How did
yes.
Robin Hood
manly
prepare?
Men. Wearing tights. I had such empathy for women after that movie. I did to begin with, but then after that, respect. I mean, crazy respect. I mean, them things is itchy and uncomfortable. I mean, who are you kidding? Guys, I'm telling you, don't ever say to a lady, hey, you know, you should probably put some tights on. No. They're not going to go, for you, honey? Sure. As you wish. Not going to happen. Right, ladies? Am I right? It was in the title, so I had no choice. Tried to talk Mel out of it. Tried very hard. But it was very funny. I mean, it is a funny title. Yes, I can't remember a day without laughter on that show either. I mean, Mel was hilarious to work with. Really fun. Just Dave Chappelle. I mean, Dave Chappelle. Just ran into him. I haven't seen him in 25 years, I think. 22 years. Just ran into him in New Orleans and went to see his show. He's touring again. And I thoroughly recommend don't take the kids, obviously. It's an adult show, but it's hilarious, and he's brilliant, and he's back touring again. So, I don't know. People have been asking me to write that book. What do you think? Shall I? Yes? Well, okay, then. Thank you. Thank you for your question. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
For moderating this event. Thank you to the Tattered Bookstore for putting on this event. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to all the staff. And thank you all for coming. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.